From the Captain Cook Hotel, this is live coverage of the National Transportation Safety Board hearings into the wreck of the Exxon Valdez. I'm Bruce Melzer. With me is Steve Heimel. Live coverage of these hearings are being brought to you by KSKA Anchorage and APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network. We are now waiting for the panel to reconvene. They took a lunch break. When they left, on the stand was Frank Iarossi, president of Exxon Shipping Company. And we expect that he will be back on the stand as soon as we reconvene.
It was rather surprising when Iarossi talked about his knowledge of Joe Hazelwood's drinking and drug treatment record. This is something that earlier he had said that he had known very little about.
Steve, you were at those early press conferences in Valdez and covered Iarossi when he had talked about that.
Yes, it was brought up very early on. Of course, at that point in time, he was a very busy man and had a lot of people telling him things and asking him things, but he really claimed at that time, to best of my recollection, not to know anything about Hazelwood's record. And furthermore, he said he really didn't think it was any of his business.
And in fact, we find out from his testimony today that as far back as 1985, when Hazelwood checked himself in to a rehabilitation program, unbeknownst to the company, and then the company tried to track him down. They were trying to get a message to him, and then all of a sudden they found out he was in a hospital with an alcohol rehabilitation program. The company then gave him 90 days of leave, and according to Iarossi's testimony this morning, then set up a system to monitor him. And the way Iarossi tells it was the first time that they actually ever had to do something like this. Their system consisted of basically meeting with him or checking him out when he was in the home port. Whatever that happened to be, often it was either Long Beach or Benicia in the San Francisco Bay Area.
We had a look at the job evaluations of Joe Hazelwood, and they show kind of an undistinguished career, a man who seemed never to be able to live up to his potential, but there's very little reference to alcohol there.
That's true. There are documents floating around. Other reporters I have spoken to have gotten copies of disability applications where Exxon specifically mentioned that Hazelwood had applied for disability on this.
Well, we should, I would imagine that they're nowhere near finished with Frank Iarossi.
It's going to be a long day for Frank.
He is, and for us, because there are more witnesses, including Dennis Kelso of the Department of Environmental Conservation, still scheduled for today. And Lee Dickinson seems bound and determined to get through the day's agenda no matter how long it takes. So I can't imagine that they wouldn't be asking Mr. Iarossi about something about what happens once the oil is spilled, and they really haven't gotten into that at all, have they, Bruce?
No, they haven't, and they also have really only gotten through the safety board staff people. They have not even started in, the various parties have not started in questioning Iarossi, and we're going to have the Coast Guard, we're going to have the state all questioning him, Bob Loresch for the state, Commander Waldron for the Coast Guard, it is highly likely will have a long, long list of questions for Frank Iarossi. As we've seen throughout these hearings, the four parties who are involved, you have the National Transportation Safety Board itself, and its agenda is to sort of find out what caused the accident and what changes can be made. And then there are four parties, the Coast Guard, Exxon, Alyeska, and the state of Alaska. And all those parties have their own interests here, and they don't always match with the interests of the safety board. Many of them are trying to build a record, trying to show that either their people did or did not do something.
And here we go back. Frank Iarossi is about to sit down. He's pouring himself a little water and being welcomed back. And after lunch, the NTSB is about to recommence its probe.
For Mr. Iarossi?
Yes, sir. I'd like to ask a few more questions, if I may.
The question will start with Merritt Berkey from the National Transportation Safety Board.
Exhibit 5B to Mr. Iarossi, please. I don't believe those pagers are numbered, so you may have to bear with me here on directing questions. If you would look at the 5B exhibit that has 82 to 83 at the upper right-hand corner. Do you have that in front
of
you?
Yes.
In terms of that evaluation. If you could turn to the next to the last page on that, if you would.
Of the entire package?
No, of just that section 82 to 83. I think there's about 7 pages there, are there? It's actually the 5th page of that 82-83.
Appraisal, development, and summary?
Dr. Berkey?
Yes.
I think there's a, under explanatory notes at the bottom of the page, there's a number. Starts with E. Is that, can you give that number? Would that help to identify the correct page?
Well, the one I'm looking at, May, is E72005152-3.
Yes.
I assume that number is significant, but we won't go into that. What is meant by that recommended developmental activities on onboard console MGT2? What is the significance of that?
I don't know.
And then there's a recommendation, I believe, that he be given shore assignment for 6 months. Is that under the developmental work experiences?
That's what it says, yes.
Was that actually done at that time, do you know?
No.
It was not done.
That's right.
And then I noticed the performance rating has the box with three marked with an arrow above. Do you know the significance of that?
No, I do not.
Looking now at the next set of documents, which is the 6183 to 6184, and if you could turn to the 5th page of that.
Same appraisal and development summary?
Yes, and the page number on that with those numbers we gave before, the last 5 digits is 5158-0.
Yes.
Again, there's a statement there that says shore assignment needs a challenge. Do you know the significance of that and whether it was followed up on in terms of a shore assignment?
I do not.
On the third page of that document, which is 5156-4, would you read that comment at the bottom there?
I don't know whose comment it is. Joe does not try to achieve the true potential his gifted intelligence warrants. Needs motivation. That the one you mean?
Yes. Yes. Do you know if any action was taken based on that comment and how long?
I don't know whose comment it was, and I don't know what action was taken.
Pardon me?
I don't know whose comment it was or what action was taken.
Would it make any difference whose comment that was? I assume it was his superior's evaluation of him, correct?
I would imagine so, yes. There's no signature on it, though, from what I can see.
Well, as I understood your testimony earlier, that you participate in decisions regarding the evaluation of masters. Is that correct?
Oh, I think we're talking about promotion to master.
Okay, promotion to masters.
Did
you not? Did you not follow up the development of those masters once they've been selected by you?
No, that's the fleet operations manager and the human resources manager. We have about 1,300 employees.
Once an individual becomes a master, do you participate in the decision as to what vessel he is assigned to?
No.
So you would have...
That's made by the ship group coordinators with the review by the fleet operations manager.
Is a sheet that was referred in your earlier testimony on the classification of Mr. Hazelwood familiar to you in terms of his rating among the other masters?
I believe he was an average performer.
Have you looked at that page of the Exhibit 5B?
I believe I have the one, yes.
How would you classify the desirability of being a master on the Exxon Valdez, according to all these masters you have, or the vessels you have?
From their perspective?
How would you classify it? Is it a nice job? Is it one of the worst jobs or one of the best jobs?
I think some of the masters would prefer to be on clean product ships. They find that much more challenging.
Well, in the overall rating of those, the master of various vessels, how would this one rate as far as you're concerned? In the upper half, lower half, in terms of desirability?
I don't think the fact that it's the newest ship has any particularly appeal for the masters in the fleet. We don't have any seriatim. If you get to be on this ship, you're at the top of the pile. There's no association with a good job as the biggest ship.
Do you ever participate in discussions with those below you as to the assignment of individuals to various vessels?
Rarely. If there's some special circumstance that comes to my attention, I might ask that.
And what would be those circumstances that would bring it to your attention?
Oh, I think I watch very carefully the two chemical and specialty ships that we have operating on the Gulf East Coast. They are probably the biggest challenge to a master because of the complexity of the vessel and the fact that they move 20 or 22 different products at a time. So those ships always draw my particular attention.
Would vessels that have the potential for causing a catastrophic disaster if something went wrong come to your attention?
Yes, and that would include just about every ship we operate. You know, 240,000 barrels, that's a part load on even our smallest tanker operating in Valdez.
Under those conditions you just outlined, did at any time the Exxon Valdez come to your attention and the assignment of a particular master to that vessel?
I think at the time Captain Hazelwood was selected for the Valdez, I asked for the reasoning for that. The answer I got is that he was our most experienced master in terms of operating in and out of Valdez, and that satisfied me.
By the most experienced master, can you explain that a little bit more?
As far as the length of time, number of voyages that he operated in and out of Valdez.
And how long had he been doing that?
He was on one of the original vessels at the time that the Valdez terminal operations began. And there were a number of years when he operated out of Valdez. I don't know whether it was 5 or 6 or 8.
So the fact that his overall rating was, as according to this document, was in the order of 33%, I guess. That is, he was in the lower half of the ratings of the masters you had, did not concern you in terms of his ability to operate that vessel safely?
Yeah, this is a seriatim of all of our masters. And they are placed in what we call a forced ranking from what is viewed by their supervisors collectively as the best performer down to the least performer. Even the least performer is fully qualified. We're not talking about people who are not qualified from the standpoint of their license, their experience, and their performance. In our company, we have a forced ranking process. We go through the discipline of saying, fine, we've got 38 masters, all of them fully qualified, but now we want to decide Based on the past year's performance, who do we consider had the highest performance and on down? So we go through that force ranking process. But because a person is average or at the one-third level or the one-quarter level, that in no way means he's unsatisfactory as far as we're concerned. It's a very, very tough group to compete in. They are all excellent, outstanding people.
Do you have a process or procedure by which you try to enhance the capabilities of those at the lower end of the scale?
Yes, we do, and that's what the whole performance appraisal process. There's two parts to this. There's the performance appraisal, and we just talked about a couple of those sheets. And the purpose of the performance appraisal is to very directly and very openly define strengths and weaknesses for each individual. And then it's up to the supervisor to begin counseling, to begin activities which will enhance the strengths and try to improve the weaknesses. And the first step of that is awareness. And that's why this sheet, or let me say awareness on the part of the person being reviewed, that he at least is being perceived as having weaknesses. Those weaknesses are identified. The individual, the rater, and the person being rated are encouraged to talk their perceptions over, because after all, we're dealing with perceptions, not reality. So we have to talk over those perceptions, why the individual might think his performance is better than the supervisor thinks it is. So that's the whole first part. That is meant to identify areas where the individual can improve. The ranking process, the seriatim, which comes up with a list of names, 1 through 38 for a population of 38, that is more a process to determine how pay is allocated.
I noted when you gave the selection factors, I think, for the master position, you listed, I think, four, but I believe you stated there were five.
Yeah, five. One was...
One was the technical professional skills, management skills was two, three was judgment, and four was supporting the company policy. What was the fifth one?
Leadership skills, people skills or leadership skills. It was professional, technical, management, people or leadership, judgment, and company support of company policies.
Where would safety fall into those, or aware of safety issues fall into those selection factors?
I'd say it's in part professional, technical, and in part management.
I have no further questions at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Berkey. Mr. Howitt?
William Howitt from Alyeska.
We have no questions
Pipeline
at this
service
time.
Company.
Thank you.
He declined a question. Coast Guard Commander Daryl Waldron is now asking questions, about to ask questions.
Rosa is someone that was in Valdez for the first 2 weeks. I can attest to the extraordinary effort that your company went to get supplies and materials from all over the world.
Commander, we had a lot of help from a lot of people, including all the Coast Guard organization. In this whole effort, the only thing I can say is that we tried as best we could as associated with that 240,000 barrels, and we are just absolutely devastated as to what's gone on.
I have a few questions. One concerning the exhibit that we just talked about. I do not have any evaluations from 624 to 387. Are these evaluations available?
I don't know. We try to do it on an annual basis, but sometimes that doesn't occur.
Okay, this just appears to be the rehabilitation period that Captain Hazelwood was going through.
Yeah, I don't know who collected these particular ones. There may be evaluations in his jacket for the other years. I don't know.
Some of these also are signed and some are not signed. Is there any explanation for that?
No, they should be signed.
Do you know if evaluations were made during the rehab period?
The I don't know that.
There was a, you spoke of a special meeting with Captain Hazelwood at the 1988 conference. Can you relate to what was said?
Well, it was a meeting not with Captain Hazelwood, but about Captain Hazelwood. And it was called by his then fleet manager, and he asked for an opportunity to speak with me and with the human resources manager and for us to compare our observations of Captain Hazelwood during that five-day session. And we all spoke up about what we had seen him do, how he was reacting, how he was interacting, what he was drinking, and it was all iced tea and Perrier. The fleet manager said that was consistent with everything they have seen up to that point, and at that stage was 3 years after evaluation or rehabilitation. And I just mentioned that we needed to keep the observations going on the schedule we had, and that I wanted to know any time there was anything that appeared to be out of line. And it was about a 10-minute meeting.
We had a statement this morning from the chief engineer concerning Captain Hazelwood's drinking. We had a previous statement made after the casualty by the radio officer that also attested to the drinking on this occasion and related one other occasion on the vessel that may or may not have been involving alcohol. Is there any?
I sure wish they had passed on that information. We wouldn't be here.
Do you have any requirement or any methods for crew members to pass that type of information, bypassing the management on the vessel?
I know in one of the meetings I had earlier than this 88 meeting, the fleet manager told me that he on purpose, when he would visit Captain Hazelwood, would also talk to other members of the crew and try to elicit from them if anything was really out of the ordinary going on, in particular to Captain Hazelwood. Other than that, we have no hotline number or anything like that.
Thank you. I have no further questions.
Dr. Laresh.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, Mr. Irasi.
Good afternoon.
Early on in your appearance here today, you pointed out that when you took command or became president of Exxon Shipping, there were about 1,000 employees in the ocean fleet.
That's right.
End of the business.
That's right.
And now there are about 850 of those employees.
There were. You want me to explain the difference? That's right. There are about 850 to 900.
Is the ocean fleet smaller now in terms of ships?
Yes, it was 19 ships, and it's now down to 16 operational ships.
And is the total tonnage reduced proportionally?
The tonnage is probably up slightly. We retired a number of older, smaller vessels.
Was this reduction by 150 employees, 150 Ocean Fleet employees, was that financially successful? Did you save money because of this?
Well, we had no jobs for them, and it was carried out strictly by normal attrition. We didn't lay anybody off. We just didn't rehire as people retired or went on to other careers.
To replace these 150 employees, how much annual compensation would that involve for your company?
I guess the average salary for our seagoing people, including benefits roll-up, is probably about maybe $45,000 for the unlicensed employee and something like $65,000 for the officer, average case.
So several million dollars in total then.
Yeah, but we also don't have the use of the facilities either that went along with the people.
I understand. We all in Alaska, we all are very aware of the reduction in force that came in the major oil companies 3 or 4 years ago. Was that one of the reasons for your reduction?
We did reduce some shoreside people with the corporate restructuring, but we did not impact any seagoing people. Seagoing people were not part of the shoreside restructuring. We reduced primarily the Houston staff operation.
Were any of the people who took advantage of these of the opportunity for early retirement, or however Exxon handled it, were any of those senior and expert people in oil spill response that were in your contingency plan at that time?
Not within the shipping company, no.
Within the corporation?
I don't really know. There's one individual I believe he left mid-86, and that was Mr. Lindblom. But we still retained him on retainer, and he was mobilized both for the Hawaii spill and the Exxon Valdez.
As an officer of Exxon Shipping, do you feel it's your responsibility to have a close working knowledge of the people who are employed under the spill response group within the parent corporation?
Those people that I would interface with, normally I'm not a part of the normal spill response activity. I would be mobilized in Houston, not at the scene. Considering the magnitude of the Exxon Valdez spill, I mobilized quickly.
So the corporate policy then apparently is to segregate the response group from the group that contains the assets that would cause these kind of accidents.
No, I would be part of the response group, but I would be part of the headquarters response organization. And the on-scene commander would be reporting back to Houston through me. That's under the normal plan as you see it, or as you would see it in the response plan. In this event, or in this particular incident, recognizing the magnitude of it right off the bat, I was the first one on the plane.
I have a few questions about the scheduling, crew scheduling practices and officer scheduling practices of your company. Generally speaking, what's the policy of Exxon Shipping? On what do you base assignments to a particular voyage of a particular vessel? Is it seniority, ability, any other criteria that you can?
Well, in the case of officers, what we strive for is what we call continuity. And by that, I mean we would assign two officers to each position on a vessel in kind of a buddy system. They would relieve each other on and off. And they would stay probably assigned to that 3 or 4 years. And we found that the benefits of that kind of continuity are very, very significant and very measurable. For the unlicensed people, we strive for the same kind of continuity, but it's more difficult because of their paid leave to duty time. For the officers, it's essentially one for one, so it's easy to assign two people to each job. For the unlicensed, it's not quite that, and therefore you have to have some rotation. And what we try to do is rotate between like vessels wherever we can.
Do you have any explanation of why the company chose to not apply this general policy in the case of the Exxon Valdez?
I believe we did. Could you help me out with your question?
Yes, Mr. Iarassi. We've interviewed many of the crew members, practically all of the officers on this voyage. Most of them had never sailed with each other before, two or three voyages before. It was a group clearly collected from all over the company and put together on this vessel.
I may be mistaken. I think Captain Stalzer and Captain Hazelwood have been on that ship for probably 2 years at least. I think Captain Stalzer was the first captain at the delivery of the ship, so he's been on there for a long time. I know that Chief Engineer Glowacki was the first engineer to take the ship out of Valdez, and he's been assigned, or out of San Diego, and he's been assigned to the ship, I believe, since then.
Okay, perhaps I misunderstood you. I thought you said you tried to ensure continuity of crews, that is, the same people would work together repeatedly.
No, not necessarily together, because they're all rotating at different times. And in fact, they can change the rotation. The normal rotation is 60 days on and roughly 60 days off for the officers. But they have the latitude, if they want to have the relief at 45 days because their daughter's graduating or their son's getting married or their wife's having a baby, they have the latitude and they just do it themselves to decide, I'll get off this trip and I'll relieve you. So the schedule, they have the latitude and they just do it themselves to decide, I'll get off this trip and I'll relieve you. So the schedule actually floats. There's no set times. We don't have a blue and gold crew.
Okay, and as the president of the company, is that your wish? Could you explain why having a blue and gold crew, as you put it, might not be superior to this catch-as-catch-can method of mixing?
Well, I don't think it's catch-as-catch-can at all, sir. I think the Navy would tell you the problems with the blue and gold crew when you totally take everybody off at one time and replace it with a totally new crew. You lose all continuity. Nobody knows what happened 3 days ago. So by having this kind of periodic rotation, you always have people that have been on board 50 days or 40 days or 30 days. You're never in a position where you wake up today and everybody is new. I think this is far superior to the blue and gold crew approach.
You feel it's more important to have people familiar with the vessel than familiar with one another?
Well, I think in the process, over time, they will get familiar with one another.
And I apologize for saying catch as catch can, but I did think I heard you say that these people schedule themselves off and on according to their personal lives.
That's right, and they're nominally on about a 60-day rotation, but they could alter that.
I would like to ask you to turn again to Exhibit 5H, which is the Exxon Shipping Company policy statement on employee alcohol and drug abuse.
Yes.
I believe you told us earlier that this policy was implemented or at least derived, published in 86 or 87 in its present form. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think page 5 has March 11, 1987.
Okay, you also said that the policy goes back to 77.
Yes, in its original form that I know of, I believe it has a January 1977 date on it. It only covered alcoholism at that time.
Okay, is the essence of the policy of 77 regarding alcoholism continued in the present policy?
Yes.
So you have had this policy on alcoholism for more than 10 years?
Yes.
Okay. I'd like you to answer this question again. I think I know what you said, but let me just ask you again. Since Mr. Hazelwood completed his rehabilitation program, exactly what did Exxon Shipping Company do to ensure that he was in fact rehabilitated?
There were two individuals directly in charge or responsible for the follow-up. That was the fleet operations manager who reports directly to me, and the ship group coordinator, or in the early stages he might have been called a port captain, who was the direct coordinator or supervisor for Captain Hazelwood. They visited with Captain Hazelwood. Just about every time he was in port, one of the two of them did, and that was on a frequency of about twice a month, every two and a half weeks, or whatever the schedule for that particular voyage pattern was.
And did you say earlier that these visits generally were at the conclusion of a voyage?
They were sometime during the import period. I don't know if it was at what time. You know, they're only in port 24 hours, so whether it's the start or the end, it's hard to tell.
And these people were monitoring him, I believe, under the policy.
They were sitting with him, talking about what was going on, talking about his activities, and talking about whether he was drinking or not. They were also making themselves available to other people in the crew.
And so basically they just sat down and had a discussion with him.
And of course they would watch with their eyes and listen with their ears and try to pick up any signs that Captain Hazelwood was not following the rehabilitation plan.
Your policy states clearly on page one that Exxon Shipping has the right to, quote, require employees to, in what I take as Mr. Hazelwood's status at this time, require employees to submit to drug testing or to alcohol testing. Can you tell me why the company decided not to implement that policy
I think the key phrase is where cause exists to suspect alcohol or drug misuse. Essentially, there had to be a cause for that.
Was Captain Hazelwood ever tested by Exxon on a follow-up basis after his rehabilitation?
Not to my knowledge.
Did Captain Hazelwood ever refuse a request that he be tested?
Not to my knowledge.
On page one of the policy as well, the company establishes their right to conduct unannounced searches of your vessels, of which the Exxon Valdez was one. Did you ever conduct an unannounced search on the Exxon Valdez?
I don't know if the Valdez was one of those 30 searches or not.
In those 30 searches, was a ship ever searched unannounced that, and which Captain Hazelwood was the master at that time?
I don't know.
What's your company's policy, your written policy anyway, in the case where a confirmed alcoholic is found after his rehabilitation to again be drinking, that is to have had one drink?
We don't have a written policy. We would clearly look for whether it was on company, whether it violated the two company policies, one having to do with use or possession on board ship, or one having to do with unfitness for duty. It certainly would be a cause for alarm for us and would trigger a much higher order of scrutiny.
But essentially, again, without probable cause, speaking generally, you did not use your unannounced search policy?
The situation never came up, so it's kind of hypothetical as to what I would do. We'd be very concerned, and that might trigger a search.
Well, of these 30 searches, were each of them triggered by some suspicion or event?
A few might, but most of them were random selection. Very closely held random selection. I think a few of them were triggered by masters who suspected some something or other or information we may have gotten from other crew members, but I can't tell you how many of the 30.
So there really wasn't involved or even implicit in the policy that that a master who had undergone rehabilitation for alcoholism, given the widely known recidivism rate of these people, that did not constitute something that perked your interest in the vessels that he was in command of?
Well, it certainly caused us to have an on-purpose surveillance program of him using his supervisor and his supervisor's supervisor.
Has Exxon Shipping ever been made aware of allegations of Captain Hazelwood's drinking or abuse or failure to follow any other company policies?
Subsequent to rehabilitation, no. Is that what you mean, subsequent to rehabilitation?
At any time.
I think at the time of his rehabilitation, there was one statement from someone that we could not substantiate, but it was the period prior to the rehabilitation. Prior to the rehabilitation, I don't know exactly when.
Were there any other allegations made at that time other than the captain's use of alcohol?
I don't know. Are you referring to a 1986 lawsuit?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. That lawsuit, as I recall, didn't say anything about alcohol use. What was it was associated with the medical discharge of one employee in 1984, I believe. And in 1986, January, February of 86, as I recall, the employee filed a lawsuit allegating or alleging that his nervous disorder was as a result of his sailing with Captain Hazelwood in 1980, and again in, I believe, 1982.
And where had he sailed with Captain Hazelwood, allegedly?
I don't know the vessels. I do know the years because I remember the lawsuit, but it went back to one period in 1980, one period 1982.
Was it, did these events, these alleged events, allegedly occur in Prince William Sound?
I don't know.
Worse, was one of the allegations that this litigant had been forced by Captain Hazelwood to take the con of the vessel when he was unqualified to do so?
I don't recall that.
If that had been the allegation, what would Exxon company policy have had you do in response to that?
The allegations themselves were looked into very carefully. The individual named seven or eight people who he said were aware of the circumstances. To my knowledge, all seven or eight were interviewed, and none of them supported the individual's position. No, not one individual supported it. So, and the matter is still up for litigation. I don't know. I want to talk too much more about it.
Okay, fine. You've heard testimony, or probably at least seen the NTSB report, that two bottles of something called Moosey beer were found in Captain Hazelwood's stateroom.
Yes, I've seen those reports. Moosey beer is a non-alcoholic beverage.
Well, you said earlier, this is why I'm asking you about this, that there is absolute prohibition of alcohol,
yes,
on the vessels.
Moosey beer is classified as non-alcoholic.
Okay, so according to your policy, a 0.5% beverage is classified as non-alcoholic?
Whatever the classification, whether it's federal or whatever it is, but Moosey beer comes in under it.
What percent by volume does a beverage have to have in order to be classified as alcoholic under your company policy?
I don't know. you know, it's either an alcoholic beverage or it isn't. Maybe I'll ask the ABC or something.
So your policy specifically references what the ABC says is alcoholic?
Yes.
Okay.
We would use that standard, I assume.
We also heard from some of your crew that in the past, at least, they had been served wine with holiday meals.
Yes, we had a long-standing policy, and that probably goes back as long as the prohibition on alcohol. But that policy allowed the serving of wine at the Thanksgiving meal and the Christmas meal. There was a measured quantity of wine brought aboard based on the number of people on board, and I think in recent years it's been those small wine containers that you might get on airlines for $2 or whatever they charge you.
Yes, sir, but this was a considered waiver of your strict prohibition against alcohol.
Yes.
Okay.
We stopped that after 1987.
I was going to tell you that a couple of your crew members mentioned that you had shut that off.
Yes, it had considerable unhappiness because we were destroying an old tradition, but we felt under the times it was time to do that.
Your policy also calls for an employee to be immediately removed of his or her duties if observable physical signs of use or abuse are encountered, including the smell of alcohol on the person's breath. If you had smelled alcohol on Captain Hazelwood's breath on the bridge of the Exxon Valdez prior to departure, as was observed by more than one person, would your policy have required you to relieve him of his duties at that time?
I'd have to go back and look at that policy. Does it say that removal of the individual for smell of alcohol? I think the policy says unfit for duty.
So are you saying that once you smelled alcohol, you'd have to come to another decision as to whether or not the person was unfit for duty?
I'd certainly have to scrutinize him very, very carefully to determine whether there was any sign at all that he was unfit for duty or in any way impaired. I've listened to television the last 3 or 4 days and haven't heard one individual say that he was in any way impaired.
So it's not clear whether the smell of alcohol in the breath is grounds for doing anything or not?
I think it's a clear sign that you have to go further and make a determination.
This policy, as well written and as well written as it is, seems complex to me, and I'm sure it was for some of your officers who were required to implement it. What did you do to train these people to implement this and other Exxon Shipping Company policies?
It was one of the subjects in at least three of our fleet officer conferences, those that I spoke about this morning, particularly in relation to drug and alcohol awareness. And most recently, the sampling process. As you know, we've put aboard some very good drug and alcohol sampling kits. I think Mr. Delosier mentioned yesterday that they're first class equipment, and we've had training particularly on the custody part of it, how to maintain a verifiable custody.
Now, on these fleet officers' conventions or meetings,
conferences. About five-day meetings that we had, and they, over the period of 5 days, we'd get into a wide range of subjects.
They were, they included fleet officers down to what level?
Chief mate and first assistant engineer. They took the top four grades, and that's half of our officer population.
And you feel
about 180 or so officers total.
Do you feel those conferences gave these people an added education and added means in which they could go back to their vessels and enforce these policies before the fact to prevent this sort of thing? Did you train them techniques of personnel management in order to implement the policies?
Yes.
And has every person at or above that rank gone through this training?
They all should have been through those conferences. Now, the first two, I think, were in about the 82 to 84 period. So if you had some officers move into the chief mate rank since then, they may have missed those first two conferences. The last one was 1987, I believe, the 87 conferences.
The 87 conference, so anyone who has achieved that rank and been given those responsibilities in the last 2 years has not been trained and given the tools to do this?
Well, we have some very clear instructions. We've had three letters that went out to each individual employee, one in 85, one in 87, one in 88, so anybody who was an employee, I think the last letter was September of 88. They have been made very aware. Excuse me. They should be very aware of what the policy is. You know, there's two very simple points to the policy. The first one says you shall not possess, use, alcohol or illegal drugs on board our vessels in any way, and the second says that you shall not be unfit for duty in any way as a result of alcohol or drug use.
And you conveyed these policies to your employees through written correspondence?
Yes, directly to each employee. This, in addition to being a bulletin board type thing, each and every employee got a letter at his home.
Who signed those letters, sir?
I believe I signed two of them. The third was either signed by the human resources manager or the fleet officers, or fleet managers, I don't recall.
I'm sorry, you have 1,500 employees? There must have been 4,500 of these letters. Who signed each of those?
I signed two of them that I recall, and the third one was signed either by the human resources manager or by the two fleet managers. I mean, you only signed the original. You don't sign 4,500 of them.
I'm sorry. So these went, you informed them of this important policy through form letters mailed to their homes?
They were not form letters. The two I wrote very, very carefully, and I would like you, I'd be glad to read them. Unfortunately, they're not exhibits, but I'll be glad to make them available to the committee. They were very carefully, sincerely worded letters to try to point out to all the employees the hazards of drug use, the effect that it has on the safety of everybody on the vessel, the effect on the world we live in. They were pretty hard-hitting letters trying to define the nature of this problem that society faces and how it impacts the shipping company.
Okay, thank you, sir. Going on to the your performance appraisal system.
Yes.
You've given a real eloquent statement of what this system is meant to accomplish. And basically, the way I understand it, please correct me if I'm wrong, is that this the performance appraisal was the first step toward a continuing program of helping each employee improve and perhaps achieve a higher ranking. Is that correct?
Yes, that's what it's targeted for.
Are you satisfied that this purpose is being achieved throughout your company?
I watched over the past few days as crew of the Exxon Valdez spoke here at this forum, and I was proud of them. I think they're a very intelligent group, handle themselves well both professionally and in a difficult forum like this. I think our results are not totally satisfactory. We'd like to have perfect results from it, but I think certainly we've made major strides in upgrading the professional management and leadership capabilities of our people.
For the performance appraisal system to work as you hope it has anyway, the your written policy regarding these appraisals needs to be followed, I assume. Going to Mr. Hazelwood's performance appraisals, I believe you said you quote, try to do these on an annual basis, but sometimes this doesn't occur.
On a formal basis. Yes, I don't know that that we have annual reports for everybody in this formal form.
What is the written company policy on how often these reports in this performance appraisal system should be?
We try to do it annually, but we don't have that written in any policy anywhere.
Okay, so there are, in the material we've been provided, there are no performance appraisals for the period from April 84 through April 87 for Captain Hazelwood, nor any more recent than April of 87. Is that pretty much a standard separation of these performance appraisals for your officers?
I don't know what the frequency was in the case of Captain Hazelwood.
What's your policy regarding following up on suggestions made in the performance appraisal?
The follow-up comes from the fleet operations manager and the human resources manager to the extent that any circumstances are brought to his attention.
Would recommendations written in an officer's performance appraisal be brought to that person's attention?
It may. I can't state that it is in all cases. Depends
upon
what it is.
I guess the simple question is, who reads these things?
They go in, well, the fleet manager would read them, and they would go into the human resources group.
To the group.
I don't know that the human resources manager reads every one. I don't believe he does.
But if the policy is to follow up on recommendations, if possible, whose responsibility is it under that policy to do the follow-up, to read them and follow up?
The fleet manager, to the extent he has the ability to do that.
Do you mean to the extent that he has the time to read them?
No. If it's a recommendation on a certain training program, then, you know, do we have openings? Do we have such a program? Items like that. That's what I mean by opportunity. If it's a discussion about giving someone a 6-month sure-side assignment, then, you know, what are the opportunities for that? Who else has been recommended? Quite often there are more than one recommendation for a sure-side assignment like that, and then it's a best fit or best schedule type situation.
Do you then understand why the recommendations in Captain Hazelwood's 82-83 appraisal, performance appraisal, namely that he be reassigned to shore duty and that he be given management training, those are two recommendations in that. Do you know why those were not followed up on in this instance?
I'd have to read it. If possible, temporary shore assignment in headquarters or fleet office, he needs to be exposed to the needs of running a business. That the comment? Yeah, I don't know.
Do you have any records of whether or not anyone reviewed that recommendation and decided why not to implement it?
Well, at the time opportunities came up, I'm sure the fleet managers discussed it and chose amongst the people who had indicated a desire or a need.
Do you know that?
I know.
Okay. Does the company keep any records on what's done in response to these recommendations?
No.
Okay. You're listening to live coverage of the NTSB hearings into the wreck of the Exxon Valdez. On the stand now is Frank Iarossi, president of Exxon Shipping Company. This coverage is brought to you by KSKA Anchorage and APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.
Appraisals. I guess I'd just like to know generally what are the managerial skills in an outstanding ship's master? I guess more particularly, does that include personnel management skills?
Administrative skills, yes. Leadership skills, I personally would put in a slightly different category. I think that that leadership skills are very unique skills. And when I talk about leadership skills, I'm talking about the ability to motivate, the ability to bring people out and have them reach their potential. I would view those as separate from management skills, although you could put them in the same category.
Do you feel that this type of skill is any more or less important than the technical skill in the master?
Well, I think the professional skills are the foundation. That's a must. I think as we progress from that, then you get into a higher level, which I would say are management skills over those professional skills. And the individual can get to a higher level than that, and many do, and that's when they get into what I would call true leadership skills, where they understand not only how to administer, but how to motivate and how to get people to put forward their best. But I see it as a hierarchy. They're not exclusive, but certainly the bottom rung and the must rung is the professional and technical skills. And then as individuals of grow and improve, they move to the higher management skills and the higher leadership skills.
Which type of skill would you think is required to properly implement your alcoholism policy, as well as your general ship's orders, the policies that are contained therein?
I think those specific policies could be administered by a master who has relatively low management skills.